Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hello, my friend. How are you? Welcome to Catch Up with Louise McSharry. This is the podcast where I try and catch you up on all that is going on in the world. As it is Monday, we will be talking news in just a little while. But before we do, how are you doing? How are you? Thank you for being here. Thank you so much. And thank you all for your continued support of this podcast. It means so much to me. I really appreciate it. And I love having this, like, knowing I'm going to be coming and talking to you guys every week. And I was thinking about you over the weekend, actually, because I went to Manchester on Friday with my sister. As I mentioned on last week's podcast, we were going to look for wedding items. I kind of feel like I need to be very careful about what I say, because I don't want to give anything away, you know, about what she's chosen for her wedding looks. But yes, we were going to look for wedding items. And it was me, her lovely friend Aoife, and my mom came with us as well. And to be honest, I was a bit nervous about it. I didn't know how it was going to go. As you know, I don't want to go on about it too much, but I am going to go on about it a bit today. My mom has Alzheimer's disease, and it is a really excruciating thing to experience as a family member. She is only 59 years old, so she's exceptionally young for someone who has a 41-year-old daughter, because she adopted me and my brother with who I would refer to as my dad, but who is actually biologically my uncle. And so she is my aunt by marriage, but she's been my mom since I was 7. And so yeah, she's only 59. They adopted us when they were 25 and 26, and it's like just so infuriating that she did so much for other people through her entire life, and then just when it should have been time for her, she got Alzheimer's disease, early onset Alzheimer's disease. It's so grim. But anyway, that's not what I wanted to say. But anyway, she was coming with us on this trip, which made sense because obviously my sister wanted her to come, but I kind of wasn't sure whether, to be honest, it was the best idea. I wasn't sure whether she'd enjoy it and how much she'd get out of it, and I didn't know what it would be like for us logistically. Now, in the end, we actually had a really lovely time, and I think she had a nice time, and I think that it was good that she came, and I'm actually really grateful to have had the time with her. But it was certainly kind of eye-opening in terms of what my dad is doing as her carer, and what her needs are. And also, and this is the bit that I wanted to talk about, also just how kind of misinformed a lot of us are about Alzheimer's, and I'm including myself in that. Because when we think of Alzheimer's, we think of forgetting, right? So like people ask me how my mom is, and Gordon was saying the same thing last night. Like you kind of say, oh, she, you know, she's still like, you know, she knows who we are and stuff. But it is about so much more than memory. It's about your cognitive ability. You know, your brain is kind of just deteriorating, and so therefore your ability to do things is deteriorating. So I think where a lot of people think of it as just forgetting, you don't realize that actually it's things like following instructions become almost impossible, thinking about more than one thing at a time. So like, for example, my mom might ask me, she doesn't really anymore, but for a time she would have asked, could she help if I was making dinner or something? And I might say, actually, yeah, could you put the cutlery on the table? And that's too much, because what she has to do to put the cutlery on the table is she has to go to the drawer and take out the knives and forks and remember that she's taking out the knives and forks and bring them over to the table. If I say, can you go over to the drawer? She can maybe handle that. Then can you take out some forks? Then can you take out some knives? Then can you go over to the table? You have to really break things down, because anything that has like multiple steps in it, her brain just can't get there anymore. So when you're traveling with someone who can't really follow instructions very easily, it can be really tricky. And, you know, we were going through the airport through security in Manchester on Sunday, and it was just very stressful. You know, sometimes airplane security is absolutely fine, and then sometimes it's very stressful. This was one of those times when it was very stressful. And we'd been separated from my sister and her friends. So it was just me and Jer. And as we were going through, we finally got all our stuff in the boxes or whatever to go through the scanner. And then we had to step through the metal detector, and I stepped through ahead of her, which was a mistake, I now know. And then when I turned around, the security guard was saying to her, "Oh, madam, you need to take your coat off." She'd forgotten to take her jacket off, and I hadn't copped it. So, and I said, and she didn't understand. And I could see Jer kind of not panicking, but like, you know, clearly not understanding the instruction. And the woman was getting kind of a little bit aggro with her, not massively, but just impatient. And I said to her, she has Alzheimer's disease. She doesn't understand. Can I go back and help her? And she said, no, because you've come through now. And it was just this whole kerfuffle, like this whole thing. And then, you know, it was fine. We got her through. She had her jacket and her shoes had to go through the metal or the like scanner or whatever. But then she had to do the body scanner, and she didn't understand the instruction about the way that she needed to position her body. And, you know, all of this kind of, these kinds of things that seem so simple to you when you have a fully functioning brain are really challenging for her. And it just occurred to me that it would be good if more people knew that. And if more people knew that you might see someone who might have, you know, a compromised brain, and might not be able to understand things that seem like simple instructions. You know, look, I encountered a few people who were really kind over the weekend who could see that, you know, maybe there was something going on. But there was a fair bit of, you know, not dirty looks, but like weird looks, or like people who were impatient with her. And I understand that, like, we're all just functioning in our world and in our lives and doing our best day to day. And you can't always be thinking about every potential situation or circumstance that another person is in. But I did think that it might be helpful for people to kind of think about and process the fact that Alzheimer's is about so much more than memory. Because sometimes I think it is simplified down to it being about remembering things. And it's about functioning as well. And that is another really difficult aspect of a loved one having it, because, you know, they just need more and more help, which is fine, you know, if you can give it to them. And I won't get into the challenges of accessing help as carers and all the rest, but their needs are just more complex. But the main thing I think that you need when you're in this situation is patience and a bit of kind of compassion from other people. And most people are great. And obviously, you know, there were people who I kind of had to ask to just give her a minute. And once you kind of say that, people are pretty sound. But I just thought it might be helpful if people understood that. And maybe you all know that already, but I didn't. You know, I really went into this fairly ignorant, and I'm learning all the time. And it might be helpful for someone else to hear that, or it might be helpful for you in your job maybe, or whatever. So there you go. That was my learnings from the weekend. But as I say, overall, we had a great time. I'm going to make a reel actually after I upload this podcast, because we went to some really lovely eating places, restaurants, I believe they're called. We ate some really good food. We had some really nice drinks. We just had a lovely time. I really, really, really loved Manchester. It's only a half an hour flight. I will definitely, definitely be going back. So yeah, I'll have all those tips on my Instagram if you want to come over there. But now I suppose I better shut up. Oh, but before I do, I'm very sorry now. I just have to do the admin, guys. Just a little reminder that I'm doing a live show on May 9th in the Laughter Lounge in Dublin. It's a Thursday night. Get your gals, get your guys, get your gays, get your theys, get whoever. And come and join me. I think it's going to be really, really fun. Tickets are on sale now. I'll have some little announcements about what you can expect soon, but I promise you it's going to be a great night. And I'd love if you got over there and grabbed a ticket. The link is in the bio. Also, thank you again for all your continued support on Patreon. There'll be a new mailbag Patreon episode going up this Wednesday. It is all go, my friends. Now though, let's catch up on the news. Good morning, Carl Kinsella. How are you? How is your life?
Good morning, Louise McSharry. Yeah, my life is honestly, there are no exciting updates on my end, I gotta say. I should be better at like coming in hot. I should prepare personal talking.
Come on,
points.
Carl. Start doing scandalous things so that you can bring it to us.
Yeah,
we need action.
I'm trying to think, like, did I buy anything nice for myself? I bought some mosquito spray this week.
Oh, thrilling.
A lot of mosquitoes in Amsterdam. They don't tell you about that before you you move here.
It's warm there now, right? Because my friend who lives there was on a boat over the weekend and it looked delightful.
It's lovely at the moment, yeah. It's still quite chilly, but the sun is out and it's shining. Yeah, so we'll see. Yeah, hopefully this... Because, I mean, I'm starting to think that the Netherlands is one of those, like, nine-month winter kind of places where you just, like, are in the cold and the grey for almost the entire year. But it is definitely starting to pick up, so fingers crossed.
Yeah, no, from what I've seen, like, there's a good summer around the corner. Usually they get a really nice summer. So, and when are you, like, what's your plan? Because, excuse me, I know you're working on your thesis and stuff. Are you going to stay there for a long time?
No, I think once, so like, I think I'll probably submit the thesis around August. Mm. And then once that's done, I'll probably be back in Dublin, to be honest.
Well, you better start experiencing Amsterdam. Have you been to, I don't know, have you done,
I've
have
been
you
to, I've been
picked
to clubs.
Tulips?
I haven't picked any tulips. I've like, I, you know, I haven't seen any windmills, proper windmills.
Oh, come on, Carl.
Like huge oversight. Yeah. I haven't had a chance to wear my clogs, all that sort of stuff. So I do need to pick up the pace.
Okay, well, excellent. We have a lot of news to talk about, of course. So we might as well just get stuck in. And I guess we should start with our government in Ireland, because there has been a lot going on. Obviously, we talked about the fact that Simon Harris was going to be going for leader of Fine Gael. That has happened. And what's happened since then?
Yeah, so a lot has happened since then. I mean, Simon Harris has you know, acceded to the sort of Fine Gael throne. Tomorrow is when there'll be the vote in the Dáil over whether or not he becomes Taoiseach. That's expected to pass. So in the last week, Simon Harris has kind of spent a lot of time schmoozing independence, because right now the government is in quite a precarious position, in the sense I think there's only 80 government TDs right now, so that's one shy of a majority, which obviously they would need to confirm Simon Harris's Taoiseach. So getting the independence on side was actually essential. I suppose you'd say, fortunately for Fine Gael, a lot of the independents right now are just ex-Fine Gael TDs.
Right.
You know, he has Michael Lowry on side, he has Joe McHugh on side, Dennis Nocton on side. So that's, you know, right there, that's three former Fine Gael TDs who are now independents who can bump up those numbers. You also have someone like Nasa Horrigan. This is kind of a bone of contention this week. She is obviously the Green Party TD who has been outspoken on a lot of issues. She lost the whip at one point. And she has said that she is going to vote with her party and with the government in making Simon Harris Taoiseach. So that's, I mean, there's no expectation of any surprises tomorrow. We're going to have the vote and we're probably going to end up with Simon Harris as Ireland's 16th Taoiseach.
We have seen an exit as well, or like a planned exit by many Fine Gael TDs, haven't we? There's lots of talk of like Simon Harris having a new vision for the party and people saying that they don't plan to stand in the next election in Fine Gael, right?
Well, we've had almost an epidemic of Fine Gael TDs who don't intend to stand in the next election. I think right now Fine Gael have about 36 TDs, and I think around 12 of them officially have said that. So you're looking at a third. I did the maths on this the other day. It is a third of Fine Gael TDs who are not going to stand in the next election, which is, you know, that's a huge number.
And what's I think that about? Kind of like, yeah.
Oh, there's different reasons for all of them, but I think you can kind of see a through line of they think they're probably going to struggle in the next election. You know, I think that, you know, you don't want to be too cynical or too political about it, but ultimately I think that's what it boils down to. You know, if you're really enjoying your life in politics and things are flying high, I think you're a lot less likely to bow out. Whereas Fine Gael have obviously been dropping in the polls for a long time. They've been in power for a long time. A lot of the TDs are quite young. So you can kind of see maybe why, you know, someone like Simon Coveney has sort of remained tight-lipped over whether he's going to run in the next election, a bit like Leo Varadkar. He has stepped down this week as a cabinet minister, which is like, that's kind of a huge sea change for Irish politics. Like, people like Leo Varadkar and Simon Coveney, they've been in cabinet for, you know, looking at 10 plus years now.
Yeah.
So whatever Simon Harris does, you know, tomorrow Simon Harris is going to heavily reshuffle the cabinet, and the decisions he makes are going to, you know, it really will be kind of a new frontier. There's a lot of sort of speculation over what he's going to do. He's sort of been warned within Fine Gael not to demote Helen McEntee from Justice. There's kind of fears that would embolden the far right, because I think Helen McEntee is sort of seen by the far right as a bit of an enemy. So if she's gotten rid of, I think the far right would see that as a win. Otherwise, you're probably just looking at promotions for some of the younger Fine Gael TDs. You're probably looking at someone like Jennifer Carl McNeil and someone like, let me just get his name right, but I think it's Patrick O'Donoghue. He's the guy who's the Minister of States for Office of Public Works, Patrick O'Donovan. And he, at different times, has sort of had some very high profile policy initiatives. Like, he's the guy who sort of brought the cars back into Phoenix Park. He's the guy who was he organized the live crib when the live crib was cancelled at the Mansion House. He's the guy who set one up in Stephen's Green. So I'd say those are the kind of people you're going to see sort of promoted into possible ministries tomorrow.
Yeah.
But I mean there's been no leaks so far about who's going to end up where. So we're not going to know until after this is recorded anyway.
Yeah. I was going to say, I'd say today could be a bit leaky as things develop. Simon Harris did speak this week about his kind of intentions, and he had like some stronger words for Netanyahu about Israel, and he said a lot of things that I guess people wanted to hear. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I suppose so he addressed the Ardesh, the Fine Gael Ardesh, and I suppose the headline figures, probably what most people's eye would be drawn to, is the promise of 50,000 homes each year for the next 5 years. So I think it was 250,000 homes by 2030 is the plan. This would involve a huge ramp up of what Fine Gael are currently providing. I think last year, local authorities in Ireland built around 12,000 houses. And I think they missed their target by about 2,000.
I was going to say, how is that going to happen? Because they haven't been able to hit the lower targets that they're really going to have to do something to make that happen.
Exactly. They missed their targets by about 20% last year. And I mean, they pretty frequently miss their targets. You know, I think year on year, the targets tend to be missed. And I think, you know, Housing Minister Dara O'Brien has justified that by saying that the targets are meant to stretch us. They're meant to make us ambitious, and they're meant to make us try to hit them. But I mean, what's that worth when you've failed to hit them? You know what I mean? That's kind of crazy. So we've had plans like this from Sinn Féin, who've said, you know, in the region of 50,000 a year. I think Labour, Ivana Bacik, she was kind of criticised for going even further than that, because it does sound fanciful. People don't buy it, you know. People hear 50,000 homes a year after the last 14 years we've had of being short on supply. And I think people are just extremely sceptical. But I mean, that wasn't, that really wasn't all he said. There was other stuff. You and I talked about this, I think, 2 weeks ago. Something I'd noticed in Simon Harris was, since becoming acting minister for justice last year, he's much kind of tougher on crime. And some of the stuff he said this week was that he wanted to introduce mandatory minimum sentences. He wanted to introduce tougher punishments for antisocial behavior. You know, a big part of his pitch is that he wants to get sort of Dublin, quote unquote, cleaned up. And of course, you know, Dublin, there's no denying that crime is too high in Dublin. But I think people will probably raise their eyebrows at the idea of something very American like mandatory minimums. Yeah. There's a lot of research that suggests that mandatory minimums really don't do anything, because it's all responsive, right? It doesn't prevent crime. It only addresses crime after it's already happened.
Yeah.
So I think that's why people have issues with that kind of rhetoric.
But, and for people who maybe don't know, mandatory minimums is like a mandatory minimum sentence for a certain crime. So no matter what happens within the crime, if you do X crime, like let's say sell weed, you will get this sentence no matter what the circumstances are, which I think as a concept is flawed, and I think we've seen that in America, obviously.
So it's we are kind of getting a sense of the sort of tone and the kind of personality Simon Harris wants to project. Like, we also saw him give his, you know, you ain't seen, he walked out on stage at the Ardesh this week for his speech. He walked out to the clip of himself saying, "You ain't seen nothing yet," about Fine Gael.
That's a choice.
It's just like, it is a choice, isn't it? Because I feel like it's the kind of thing that it really appeals to the people in Fine Gael, but I think to everybody else, they're probably a bit like, oh God, that's quite naff.
But I suppose he, at the end of the day, he has to win over the people in the party, doesn't he? And it is their Ordesh, so I guess, you know, it makes sense. I mean, yeah. I was glad to hear, you know, for example, that he's going to increase the tax bans so that nobody earning below 50,000 euro apparently is going to pay the higher rate of income tax. That's good. Like, you know, there's bits and pieces within it that are good. But like at the end of the day, I think it's Fine Gael and it's going to be Fine Gael.
That's it. It's fairly standard Fine Gael. As you said, maybe the one surprise was how emphatic he was in calling out like Benjamin Netanyahu by name.
Yeah.
Because I think, you know, we talk a lot about how media and how politicians in the West don't tend to tackle Israel head on. They tend to use the passive voice and they tend to sort of be very evasive. Whereas, you know, just to get the quote exactly correct, Simon Harris said, "Prime Minister Netanyahu, the Irish people could not be clearer. We are repulsed by your actions." Which is yeah, wrong? Very strong. I mean, it is just kind of throwing down a gauntlet. Like, really, there's no wiggle room there. He's being very clear. Which, yeah, I did think was an interesting step to take on kind of almost day one or even pre-day one.
Yeah, and also I think if you say that on day one, then you've got to really put some action behind it. Like, you can't make a comment like that and then be wishy-washy on anything, as we've seen at times. You know, I think that at the end of the day, the government knows how the Irish people feel and they are generally on side. But I think, you know, there have been fair criticism of kind of the delay in maybe taking action that is possible in the context of our own, you know, political situation, neutrality, position within Europe and all that stuff.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Well, let's stay with Israel and Gaza. And, you know, things are not any better. In fact, I think this week has been very bad. You know, for a start, I during the week, I kind of was curious as to how much, because I was seeing these protests in Israel that Israeli people were protesting. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. And I went to kind of look at what was behind the protests and how much support Netanyahu has in terms of the action that he's taken. And what I learned was that people are very unhappy in Israel with Benjamin Netanyahu because they feel that he has not succeeded in getting the hostages back, and they feel that he is responsible for the hostages being taken in the first place. They blame him for October 7th for that attack. But they almost entirely, I think it was 96%, support the action that has been taken as a result of that. And so it seems like the Israeli people are in fact very on side with what's happened since October 7th, and for the most part feel that the type of action that's been taken is warranted. So I think sometimes we see protests and we go, oh, actually, no, Israeli people are seeing that this is really wrong, but it doesn't seem like they are. And now you have to take into account, like, you know, you're talking generations of you know, teachings and societal beliefs and, you know, the type of media that they consume. But, you know, unfortunately, it's not that there are lots and lots and lots of Israelis protesting against what is being done. It's the way that it's being done or the way that it's being handled, which is tricky.
Yeah. It can be kind of hard really to sort of pinpoint the motivations of kind of protesters in Israel. For example, you have a huge chunk of the population are Haredim, who are ultra-Orthodox Jews who they just don't believe in conscription. They don't believe that they should be called up to the army. They're, you know, at least pacifistic in that sense. They don't believe that they should be in the army. And that's, like I say, that's, I think, about 10% of the population of Israel. So they would all be heavily protesting Netanyahu because he's trying to conscript them. But again, it's not necessarily a direct response to any humanitarian qualms.
Yeah, maybe it's not pro-Palestinian by any stretch of the imagination, like, you know, the protests that are taking place elsewhere in the world.
Yeah, they're like, you know, they're tired of Netanyahu, maybe. But, and like you say, they blame him for the security failure sort of that led to October 7th. So, you know, they blame him in that respect. But like you say, that doesn't necessarily mean that they're calling for peace or for a ceasefire by any means.
Yeah.
It's been a crazy week. This week, it kind of it was on Monday night. There was a horrible attack on the World Central Kitchen in which 7 aid workers were killed, kind of from all across the world, from the US, Poland, UK. This was a very kind of, I feel like we've used the phrase turning point a million times. I think this one really did provoke a response that was sort of out of kilter with most things, because I think we saw immediately huge pressure from Joe Biden, pressure even from Rishi Sunak, who I would even class as almost even more supportive generally than Joe Biden of Israel. Rishi Sunak was saying that, you know, called for an immediate ceasefire. I think it did seem, and so there have been major developments this week. You know, Israel has pulled the absolute majority of its troops for now out of Khan Yunis. I think they've got one battalion left of an original 20. So it's a huge scaling back. But we don't really know why this is happening, because the US have speculated that it's just for them to rest up and refit. There's been other speculation that it's because they're going to redouble on an assault on Rafah, which is the southernmost city in Gaza, where 1.5 million people currently are. But there's also thinking that maybe ceasefire talks are finally making progress, because we have had reports from The Guardian this morning that in Cairo, which is where the peace talks have been held, we've had kind of progress, and that we're expecting an announcement within the next 48 hours. I don't think they're expecting, they're hoping for some kind of announcement they can make in the next 48 hours that would maybe represent a scaling back of the offensive. And I think that does sort of line up with the fact that so many troops have been pulled back. And I think it does line up with the fact that Israel have received probably more criticism this week than any other previous week. All of that being said, you are completely correct. Things have not gotten better on the ground. The death toll has continued to rise. Aside from the 7 aid workers, there have been many more atrocities perpetrated against Palestinian people.
I think it's been pointed out repeatedly over the last week that, like, the outcry over these 7 lives is not matched by the outcry for the thousands, tens of thousands of Palestinians who've died. And, you know, that is undeniable and really lays bare, I think, the way that we value people and value life in these kinds of situations. But, you know, it is what it is, I suppose.
I mean, it's certainly, I think you put it perfectly, it lays bare certain biases that exist kind of throughout the Western world, and clearly we've seen those come to the fore this week. It is sort of strange, as you say, to think about, because it does seem like this event, this truly horrible and tragic event, this does actually seem to have contributed somewhat to a push towards peace. Because, as you say, we've seen all the atrocities, we've seen all the horrors, we've seen, we haven't had a situation where, for example, you know, the UN Human Rights Council votes for like a halt on a worldwide halt of arms sales to Israel. You know, that's a huge step forward. Of course, countries aren't going to play by those rules. The US is still going to, you know, it certainly hasn't stopped selling arms to Israel. So, you know, unless Biden is prepared to take that step, then I think the ball remains in Israel's court in terms of they're just going to continue to do whatever they want to do. But it does feel this week like the pressure is truly on Netanyahu, both from inside Israel and from outside Israel. And, you know, I feel like it's too early to start making predictions, but it does feel like it has been quite a significant week in the conflict, and that maybe we are not necessarily entering a new phase, but just that things could perhaps start to take a different shape than they have for the last 4 or 5 months.
Yeah. It's just so galling to see, though, Rishi Sunak and Joe Biden like make comment when you are like you're giving them with your hand behind your back, you're giving them weapons and selling them weapons. Like, you are making this happen. Like, I just don't understand, you know, countries like the UK, America, Germany are responsible for them having the weapons to continue this conflict. So like, it could all end. But, you know, it's, oh, I just find it so frustrating. That's not new news. That's just me expressing frustration.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, I think a lot of people who have children and indeed individuals will have been relieved to read about McDonald's decision to buy back its restaurants in Israel, because boycotts had a real impact. My kids have been really struggling without McDonald's, I have to say, over the last 6 months. Yeah, yeah. They just love McDonald's. Kids love McDonald's, you know. But we have not been. I think we did have it once because we were on a motorway and it was the only option. But like, you know, they really understand why we made the decision not to eat McDonald's over the last 6 months. And it was great to be able to tell them over the weekend that McDonald's made this decision, even though it's such a teeny tiny thing within the context of the entire conflict. But yeah, tell us more about that.
Yeah, so that's, if people aren't aware, McDonald's are currently on the BDS list, which is Boycott, Divest, and Sanction, which is a movement kind of that is very prominent in Palestine and outside of Palestine, which is the idea that we should be boycotting and not investing in and indeed sanctioning kind of products that are made by the Israeli government in a way that affects the sort of the occupied territories in Palestine. McDonald's have been under fire for that since the start of the conflict because their stores in Israel are owned, you know, by local franchisers, you know, people, you know, same way it works in lots of places. But because, you know, they have that level of autonomy of being a franchise, they were able to support the IDF, and I think they gave them free meals. So, I mean, I know they gave them free meals. It's widely reported that they gave them free meals. So that is kind of a big part of why McDonald's ended up on the BDS list. I mean, as of right this moment, this is still a plan. So like, they're still technically on the BDS list, but McDonald's have announced their plan to buy back. It's 225 McDonald's franchises. They're going to buy them back. And yet it could definitely be seen as a big win for boycotting, because clearly McDonald's now feel they need to make commercial decisions on the basis of the losses they're suffering as a result of the way their franchises have behaved in Israel. So it's really interesting. You know, it'll be interesting to see what McDonald's do after they buy the franchises, because, you know, if they keep them open and operating, is that enough to remain on the BDS list? You know, the BDS list, it's not exhaustive. It doesn't cover every single company that, you know, you could potentially boycott. There's also been confusion over it at certain times. You know, Starbucks have faced huge boycotts, even though I think the BDS list would not really prioritize Starbucks at all.
I think it's worth, actually, if you're someone who's interested in boycotting, it's worth like visiting the website and really assessing, you know, do a bit of research and assess kind of, you know, who's there and why they're there, because the whole kind of root of BDS is that there are a small number of brands who they ask people to boycott, and at the top of that list is Hewlett-Packard, Siemens, AXA, Puma, Israeli Fruit and Veg, SodaStream, Ahava, who were like a Israeli cosmetics site, and a hummus company, an Israeli hummus company. But like, those are the main ones. And it's actually, McDonald's isn't there. Like, a lot of the brands that you hear about aren't there, because they believe that actually a focused approach is more effective than a scattergun approach. It's more effective to pick these core businesses that really, really cause damage, as opposed to businesses that are kind of maybe affiliated with something that might cause damage. You know, it's a bit more complex than that, but it is worth kind of educating yourself. You know, there are a lot of lists flying around. It's worth going and having your own look and understanding why you're making the choices, you know, why you would boycott something, and what's the most effective way to do it, I think, because I think there's a lot of conversation about it, and I think some people are a bit confused.
Yeah, and I would just add that it's bdsmovement.net is where the official list is. Because as you've said, there are thousands of lists you see flying across social media that you just have no idea where they even originated. It could just be someone putting together a random list of companies. So yeah, bdsmovement.net is where you want to find out the actual list.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Okay, anyway, great news for my kids. Okay, let's move on. The journal, so last week, if you listened to the interview on last week's podcast, it was the week before, Pastiche was on, who is an Irish pop music artist, and she was talking about her experience with endometriosis and freezing her eggs at age 25 and 26 as a result of it. And her story was pretty rough, like in terms of how hard she had to fight to get an endometriosis diagnosis. Sorry, that should be the name of like a pop band or something. Endometriosis diagnosis. It was really hard for her. She really had to fight to get it. And there are so many women who are in the same boat and who are just generally dissatisfied with the services on this level in Ireland. And I saw that the journal did a massive kind of investigation into it. And I didn't realize this, that there are lots of Irish women who are actually traveling abroad to access surgery.
Yeah, so this was an investigation by the journal in conjunction with its investigative arm, Noteworthy. And it was discovered that between 100 and 150 Irish women a year travel specifically to Romania for surgery on endometriosis. Mm. That would suggest to me as well that presumably there's also other numbers traveling to other countries, I would wager. But that's a pretty significant figure. I think what's even kind of more shocking, or the even more significant figure to come out of the investigation into endometriosis, is just how many Irish women are on the waiting list for gynecological services. You got 2,000 people in 2024, or no, more, 4,000 people in 2023 were waiting a year or more to be seen. And in some cases, nearly 2,000 cases, that's 18 months plus. Mm. So you're talking about like huge waiting lists for care.
The people who have managed to get referrals in the first place, because there are lots of women who struggle to even get referred.
Absolutely, because I mean, there is just a very well-established sort of gender bias in medicine. It can be very hard to get diagnoses, particularly for things like endometriosis, sort of things that are pain conditions. Mm. Endometriosis, I mean, like, you know, is there any point in explaining what it is to the listener? I feel like...
Well, no, I think there is, to be honest, because I think a lot of people don't fully know what it is. It's symptomatic of endometriosis is like extremely painful periods and stuff. But endometriosis can actually happen in lots of different places in the body. And it's basically a buildup of, what do they call the stuff? I mean, it's gunk, essentially, that builds up in various parts of your body. But it can lead to real pain and discomfort and fertility issues and lots of other problems. And it's a very real thing. It's not a theoretical thing. It's not something that's in your head. It's a physical thing that happens.
Yeah, and it requires, you know, surgery. It requires serious medical procedures to get rid of the tissue, as you say, that kind of grows in either the wrong places or it can...
Yeah, sorry, gunk is not a medical term, obviously.
Yeah. It's very frightening. So this I think this information came from the endometriosis. Well, you're right. That is a hard word to say.
Yeah.
Endometriosis Association of Ireland. And also from a conversation with doctors in Romania. So it is, I think it will surprise people to learn that Irish women are, you know, traveling as far as Romania for what is, you know, very essential healthcare.
Well, I think it will surprise some people and it won't surprise other people at all, because it's a thing that Irish women have been doing for quite some time, unfortunately.
Yeah, very true.
I just think it's a crime. It's an absolute crime. And it's just yet more evidence of women not being believed, listened to, treated properly in this country.
Yeah. And there is evidence of women not receiving proper care in Romania. Mm. Like there's, you know, this one doctor who was spoken to for the investigation, he was saying that he's seeing situations where women are coming in without this tissue properly removed, and instead it's been kind of burned away, but the sort of roots of the tissue are allowed to remain, which causes problems for future care. So I think, you know, not that I want to pass any kind of generalized sweeping judgment on like the Romanian healthcare system, but it sounds from this investigation like you're not necessarily expecting the top level of care when you travel there, which is really, really frightening. I think particularly for a condition like endometriosis, which already I think it has such a difficult effect on your life.
Yeah.
I think, and put yourself at risk of doing even further damage with a botched surgery is, you know, it's unacceptable that Irish women should be in that position.
Absolutely. So, and also just to clarify, we've been saying women throughout this conversation, and it is mostly women, but endometriosis can affect people of any gender. That includes cisgender men. So, you know, this is a real thing for lots of people. It's just mainly women. And as a result of that, you know, I think it's not taken as seriously as it would be if it was mainly men. Okay. Now let's talk about the Ivy Markets. This, if you're a Dublin person with an interest in Dublin and its development, you will be aware of the Ivy Markets and the conversation around the Ivy Markets over the last number of years. But Carl, there are lots of people who will not be in Dublin and who have not been paying attention to this. So tell us the story.
Yeah, I also realized that I just like loudly sighed while you were speaking there, but just about like the idea of trying to sort out the Ivy Markets just weighing on my shoulders.
Yeah.
As if it's like my burden.
I know.
But no, it is crazy because the Ivy Markets, they are so cool. They have the potential to be so cool. They're essentially a derelict marketplace building in Dublin city centre that has been derelict since 1996. And it seems like there is constant discussion, constant plans over how it can be rejuvenated, how it can be rebuilt. Unfortunately, there is like a dispute over ownership at the center, or there was a dispute over ownership at the center of it, which just kept the city council from doing anything. It kept anyone from doing anything for a very long time. And it has become a huge problem because the roof has started to collapse. We finally have an announcement as of this week that we're going to get some work being done on the Ivy Market. It's not going to, like, it is just to fix the roof. I think it might even just be to maintain the roof. So I feel like we're like, you know, this is phase one, and I feel like it's going to be a really slow process towards actually doing something with this market. I saw this week, I want to get his name right, the Dublin City Council chief executive, the new guy. Yeah, the new guy, I saw it, but Richard Shakespeare. Also, crazy name, Richard Shakespeare. I mean, doesn't
great name, to be honest.
It's a pretty cool name. But Richard Shakespeare said it's such a funny thing this week. He came out and he was like, yeah, it's taken a lot of time for us to get this done. It's going to take a bit more time. But by the time it's done, it's going to be better than Cork's English Market.
Ooh,
which I just think is such a funny thing. What, like, I feel like city councillors should be, or the chief executive, they should be doing that all the time. They should just be coming out and being like, by the time this is done, it's going to make Cork look like a total shithole. And it's like, you know, like, yeah, okay, I can get on board with this sort of, you know, aggressive planning.
Well, I would just love, I mean, it would be so great if it was even half as good as Cork's English Market, which is absolutely gorgeous. Yeah, I mean, in other market news in Dublin, Smithfield's fruit and veg market is set to reopen. It's been closed since 2019, so that's good news as well. They're finally redeveloping that. So, like, market news this week in Dublin, largely positive.
Yeah, fine. Yeah, the markets are looking good. Not in the stock sense, but in a literal sort of merchant kind of way.
The thing about it is that, like, you know, we wouldn't probably care if it just didn't feel like Dublin was crumbling around us and, like, all that was getting built were office buildings and hotels. You just, like, we're so desperate for any bit of cultural development that, like, even this feels seismic. And I think it's a real, it really makes it clear just how desperate we are for anything like this. Just something, please. Like, I was in Manchester over the weekend and there was just so much I loved about that city. It's about, in terms of population, it's, I think they have like 1 million more people living there than we do in Dublin. So it was almost double, not far off double in population. But it's just that it's been massively redeveloped in the last 20 years. I think actually subsequent to an IRA bomb. Now, I haven't done my full research on that, so don't take that as the gospel. But I will look it up after this and make sure that I'm not completely wrong. But it's been massively, massively redeveloped. And it just feels beautiful. It feels well thought through. It feels like it's for the people of Manchester. Like, there's green everywhere in the city. There's trees, there's plants. There's, like, it just feels very alive in a way that I just don't think Dublin does currently. And I have not been someone who's been on the Dublin's a shithole, like, bandwagon for a long time. You know, it's really only in the last kind of few years that I've been in town going, what are we doing? Like, really, what are we doing?
And Manchester used to be so miserable as well. Like, it used to be such a miserable place to go.
Yeah, everyone was telling me that. Like, taxi drivers were telling me that.
It's so nice. And like, they deal with the same kind of rain we do. So I feel like Manchester is the perfect blueprint for, you know, what could be done to make Dublin feel a little bit less derelict and a bit less crumbly. But it's certainly good because, like you say, I feel like the Ivy Market is, as it has been, symbolic of dereliction in Dublin. Mm. So, I mean, in fairness, I feel like we'd be almost getting ahead of ourselves to think that this is going to even be the first step towards it being solved. But like, let's hope it is, you know, let's hope the Ivy market is making its comeback and that it's going to be better than anything they have down in Cork.
Yeah, sorry. I'm just reading on the BBC, just in terms of that, the bomb that I referred to. In 1996, two IRA members planted the UK mainland's biggest bomb since World War II outside a Manchester shopping centre. The explosion ripped the heart out of the city centre, but remarkably no one was killed. God, thank God for that. In fact, the blast is now credited by some as kickstarting the city's regeneration. So, I mean, look, there's certainly an argument to be made there, not in any way suggesting that that was a good thing. Okay, and finally, I just love this story so much. Supermax and the GAA are having a big row. What could be more this Irish so than good. That? It's so good.
I never would have seen this coming. I would have thought that the GAA and the Supermax were just like this, you know, like yin and yang.
Best pals.
Peas in a pod.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like I would have thought kind of they were allowed to do anything that they want with each other's brand. Mm. You know, that's just a total free for all.
Like peas and carrots.
But apparently not. So exactly. So what happened this week was that the Supermax, they shared on Facebook and on their social media, they shared an April Fool's joke claiming that they would be the ones that they would be sponsoring Croke Park, so that it would be, you know, Supermax Croke Park. And that this was a joke that was sort of like making fun of a thing that happened earlier in the year where Parky Queeve down in Cork. Sorry, Cork is really getting it in the neck this
yeah,
week.
Yeah, sorry. I love Cork, by the way, for the record.
I actually love Cork as well. I don't even buy into slagging off Cork that much.
No, I love Cork.
No, this morning, unfortunately, it's just a you're not getting any wiggle room today, Cork. But so the Parky Queeve thing, where like that was, you know, that was named for Super Value. Super Value came in and sponsored it. At first, people were up in arms. They really didn't want it, but it's happened anyway. So I think, you know, that was kind of the joke. So yes, Supermax came out. They were like, we're sponsoring Croke Park, April Fools. And the GAA were like, that's not funny. They were just like, do not ever. They were like,
how dare you?
Keep our trademarks out of your funny little joke, Supermax. And that's literally what they said. They were like, nobody has the right to use our trademarks. And apparently Croke Park is one of the trademarks, which is, I mean, like,
nobody jokes about Croke Park.
Exactly. Are we all not allowed to joke about? I saw Waterford Whispers had a good headline that was just like, you know, let's see how far we can push the GAA on this trademark thing, which I just think is a really funny idea. Because I feel like it could just be something that we all do now where we just, you know, make a lot of jokes about Croke Park. But I do think a funny element of this story, right? And this, maybe this won't be funny to anyone else, but they didn't post it on April Fool's Day. They posted it on the 31st of March, right?
Oh.
And I think you'll probably relate to this, Louise, as someone who gets loads of emails from PR, you know, like companies and brands and stuff. And they started doing April Fool's stuff before April Fool's.
Mm.
And that's just against the rules. That's just not right. You can't do that.
I agree. And you I think in terms of a legal defense, it really puts them in hot water, because how can you say something's an April Fool's joke if it's not on April 1st?
Yeah, there's like a clear 24-hour period in which you're allowed to do anything. And that's called April Fool's Day. Mm. And if you do your, you know, your Croke Park joke ahead of time, you know, yeah, I can see. But I mean, obviously, there's not going to be any like serious consequences here for anybody. But it, as you say, the idea of Supermax versus the GAA just over an April Fool's gag is really something good, you know?
It's like, yeah, it just doesn't make sense for them to be in a row. It doesn't make sense. And for the record, Supermax is delicious. And as a dub, I think some dubs have a certain attitude about the food of Supermax. And I certainly would have been one of those people until I lived in Galway, which is essentially Supermax HQ, and absolutely became converted to the delights of a Supermax on the way home from a night out. So you just hate to see these guys fighting. Do you know what I mean? Two wholesome concepts.
Yeah, you're right. And it's really funny. In March, owner of the restaurant chain Pat McDonough said there needed to be more clarity over what GAA sponsors can and cannot do. And it's like, just because you sponsor a GAA jersey doesn't mean you own any part of the GAA and stuff. You know,
it's wild. It's all wild. It is
really funny.
Well, Carl, that's all for now. Thank you so much. Lots of great updates this week. Are you doing anything exciting today?
No, I have. I mean, like I say, I'm in the thesis home straight now. So I'm pretty much just, doing this, doing my journal shifts, and then locking myself in my room.
I was just going to say, like, you just couldn't get me to study again in any capacity. But maybe you could. I suppose it would have to be something that I was very interested in. But fair play to you is what I'm saying. In short, fair play to you. You can read Carl Kinsella's column, Surrealing in the Years, at thejournal.ie every Saturday. It's excellent. I highly recommend it. And he also writes other stuff for the website. So, website, that feels like very 1992 for the news organization.
It is a website.
And an app, obviously. Anyway, you can find Carl over there. Carl, I hope you have a great day.
Thanks, Louise. You too.
That's all from me and Carl. I will be back with you on Wednesday with the entertainment episode. Very much looking forward to talking about the celebs, as usual. And then there will be a Patreon episode later this week as well, on Thursday, a mailbag episode. And then on Friday, we'll be back with another interview. And actually this week, the interview I'm very excited about. I haven't recorded it yet, so I don't want to give any more information in case something goes wrong. But it's the kind of interview that I've really wanted to do for the last 6 months. So I think that you guys will really enjoy isn't the word, but it's going to be really good, I hope. Anyway, I'm talking so fast, I can't breathe. So maybe you can't even understand me. Anyway, thank you so much for being here. Thank you to Acast for having me on the network. I will talk to you in a couple of days.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.